Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper, The Courier, for Thursday, April 22nd, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. Happy Earth Day today. Little humor for you listeners as we begin. Why are recycle bins optimistic? Because they are full of cans. We have a beautiful Earth Day today with mostly sunny skies and a high of 62. It's 46 today, right now for our current temperature. All right, our headline stories for The Courier. First headline is suspect and troopers slain, jailed. Another headline, a temple of the arts. Congress diving into policing legislation. And governor pushes vaccinations as demand legs are our headlines for the front page of The Courier today. We'll start off with the top headline, suspect and trooper slain, jailed. Michael Thomas Lang charged with murder after leaving hospital, by journalist Jeff Renounci. Grundy Center. Bond has been set at $3 million for a Grundy Center man accused of killing a state trooper in a standoff on April 9th. Michael Thomas Lang, 41, was taken to jail Wednesday after he was released from the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics in Iowa City, where he was treated for multiple gunshot wounds he received in the shootout at his barricaded home. A district court judge had filed an Ed Thomas order in the case requiring hospital officials to notify law enforcement when Lang was about to be released from their care. Lang made an initial appearance in Grundy County District Court and then transferred to the Blackhawk County Jail in Waterloo. Lang, who had unsuccessfully launched a run for the Grundy Sheriff's seat last year, is charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, and an assault on an officer. Authorities say Lang killed Sergeant Jim Smith with the Iowa State Patrol with a shotgun as officers attempted to detain him following a traffic stop and chase. The attempted murder charge stems from allegedly trying to kill state troopers in an armed vehicle during the standoff. The assault charge pertains to an attack on Grundy Center officer Cody Niehaus, according to court records. Grundy Center police attempted to pull Lang over for a traffic stop at 7:22 p.m. on April 9th. Lang fled and was chased to an area southeast of town. Lang pulled over on 250th Avenue, exited his vehicle, and assaulted the Grundy Center police officer who chased him. During the assault, Lang yelled, "Shoot me," several times to the officer. Lang disarmed the officer of his taser, removed his radio, and put the officer in a chokehold, the affidavit alleges. Other law enforcement officers responded to the area of the assault. A Grundy County Sheriff's deputy arrived on scene, drew his weapon, and told Lang to put his hands up. Lang did not comply, stating, "Come and get me," and got into the vehicle and fled the area. During the chase, the deputy lost sight of Lang and went to Lang's home at 305 G Avenue, where he saw Lang's vehicle parked in the driveway and Lang walking into the house through the garage. Responding officers set up a perimeter around the house. Lang's father arrived at the house and advised law enforcement that Lang had multiple firearms inside the home, including a .410 shotgun. At approximately 8:55 p.m., Smith, three additional troopers, and a Hardin County Sheriff canine unit entered through the garage. As they began to clear the upstairs of the residence, Smith was hit by gunfire coming from inside the residence, and members of the entry team saw Lang emerge from the doorway holding a black pump action shotgun. Two members of the entry team retreated into the basement while others pulled Smith from the house. Lang then barricaded himself inside the residence and refused to come out. Members of the entry team who remained in the basement stated that Lang made several statements about having shot Smith and expressed a desire to shoot more police officers. Lang remained barricaded inside the residence for several hours. At approximately 11:50 p.m., an Iowa State Patrol tactical team attempted to make entry into the residence with a wheeled, armored personal carrier. During the entry, Lang shot multiple rounds at the personnel carrier. Lang was subsequently taken into custody by the State Patrol tactical team. Our next headline on the front page of the Courier reads, "A Temple for the Arts. Youth Art Team Finds New Space Downtown," by journalist Melody Parker, Waterloo. There's big reveal by the Youth Art Team wasn't the unveiling of a new community art project or collaborative large-scale mural. It was the official opening of the organization's new headquarters at the Temple, 325 East Park Avenue. The Youth Art Team moved its headquarters from Main Street Waterloo Building at 212 East 4th Street in December. "We outgrew the space and we knew we wanted to stay downtown because that's where the Youth Art Team was born in 2010 and where we grew up," said Heidi Funchman, Youth Art Team Executive and Creative Director. The Youth Art Team is now settling into what was the Masonic Temple's ballroom at the top of a curved staircase. There's also an office space and a kitchen room to stow students' coats and backpacks. "It's very exciting for us. The Youth Art Team started downtown and is staying downtown," said Carol Yates, media coordinator. "We wanted an accessible space where we could spread out, and in all our projects, we're learning about the history of the community, people, and spaces. Now we're in this historic building that has been around a century, and seeing the craftsmanship that went into building it, that's art too," Funchman explained. Built in 1925, the 50,000-square-foot, multi-story former Masonic Temple at East Park Avenue and Mulberry Street has been converted into co-working spaces, such as the one devoted to the Youth Art Team. The top two levels have been remodeled into urban loft apartments. The $5 million project by Echo Development Group, led by Brent Dahlstrom, also features lounge and common areas. "Getting the Youth Art Team in the building is great. It's my favorite nonprofit in the Cedar Valley, and the work they do is incredible," Dahlstrom said. He also excited that the top two floors of the temple are finally complete. "Residents are already living in the apartments," he said, "and just two of the 27 units remain available. Original steel-built bridge trusses and brick remain exposed for an industrial look, heightened by contemporary style and modern amenities. The Youth Art Team is a grassroots group ranging in ages from 7 to 17 who have undertaken a variety of public art projects, including our Freedom Story, a 3,000-square-foot mural designed by third graders to tell the story of the civil rights movement in Waterloo. It is displayed on the river wall along the Cedar River near the Waterloo Center for the Arts. Other public art projects have included creating wooden butterflies displayed throughout the Cedar Valley, a peacock mural on the side of the Kistner Building visible from the U.S. Highway 218, a series of temporary street murals on chalk paint and the trolley bridge. In addition, Youth Art Team has sponsored summer camps on the 4th Street Bridge. Students slowly began gathering at the new headquarters in January. "Everyone has loved it. Seeing some of our old artwork displayed defines the space, and the artists can see the artwork that's been done. The space opens up opportunities for us for projects that we've been wanting to do," said Funchman. Students will soon be collaborating on the design and painting of an old upright piano. On Tuesday, members can work on their own space in an open studio. There are 30 members on a lead team and another 30 young artists who regularly participate, in addition to about 100 artists annually from the school, said Funchman. An imagination coalition of leaders are in the process of envisioning the Youth Art Team's future group. "Our projects are so collaborative and big on meaningful and important topics that you don't want to rush them. And how do you do it with as many artists as possible? We have to raise our own funding in order to work and collaborate on projects, Funchman explained. Youth Art Team relies on monthly donors and, in spite of the pandemic, had its first successful year fully on our own as a nonprofit. We are paying rent and we have monthly donors who want to see us in that space. The community has really stepped up and supported us. It's been really hard, but really awesome too. The Youth Art Team also spent last year collaborating on a book with Kamir Enshai, director of the Center of Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa. Immigrants were invited to join artists for a potluck, 7 individuals in 6 countries. The team asked guests to describe what home means to them, Funchman said. It was the last thing we did before the pandemic, and thankfully the conversations were recorded. 8 artists, ages 9 to 17, illustrated the stories, working remotely from their homes. Art materials and snack bags were dropped off for the artists by Youth Art Team staff and volunteers. Joanne Lopez, 3's daughters, are active on the Youth Art Team, and illustrations by twins Vienna and Arcelia, both 14, and Elena, 15, are featured in the new book. I'm very proud of them. They also worked on our Freedom Story mural, The Butterflies and Summer Camp at 4th Street, said their mom. Copies of Making Iowa Home can be purchased for $20 at theyouthartteam.com/shop. Our next story on the front page of the Courier, Congress diving into policy legislation. Washington. Bolstered with new momentum, Congress is ready to try again to change the nation's policing laws. Heading President Joe Biden's that the guilty verdict in George Floyd's death is not enough for a nation confronting a legacy of police violence. Legislation that was once stalled on Capitol Hill is now closer than ever to consensus, lawmakers of both parties said Wednesday, a day after a Minneapolis jury found former officer Derek Chauvin guilty of murder and manslaughter in Floyd's death. Behind the scenes, negotiations are narrowing on a compromise for a sweeping overhaul, though passage remains uncertain. Tuesday's verdict launches a new phase of a long struggle to bring justice to America, declared Representative Karen Bass, Democrat of California, in urging passage of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. This is a human rights issue in the United States of America. Meanwhile, the Justice Department is opening a sweeping investigation into policing practices in Minneapolis after the Chauvin was convicted there, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced Wednesday. The Justice Department was already investigating whether Chauvin and the other officers involved in Floyd's death violated his civil rights. Yesterday, verdicts Yesterday's verdict, state criminal trial does not address potentially systematic policing issues in Minneapolis, Garland said. The new investigation is known as a pattern or practice, examining whether there is a pattern or practice of unconstitutional or unlawful policing, and will be a more sweeping review of the entire police department. It may result in the major changes in policing in the Minnesota city. It will examine the use of force by police officers, including force used during protests, and whether the department engages in discriminatory practices. It will also look into the department's handling of misconduct allegations and its treatment of people with behavioral health issues, and will assess the department's current systems of accountability, Garland said. The Minneapolis police said in a statement that the chief, Mirando Arenado, welcomes this investigation and will fully cooperate with federal prosecutors. The revived effort in Congress, led by Black lawmakers, including Representative Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, comes at a pivotal point. The nation is on the edge over the Floyd case, the deaths of other Black Americans, including a 16-year-old girl brandishing a knife about the time of the Minneapolis verdict was announced, and almost a year of protest accusing police of brutal actions that often go unseen. The guilty verdict for Chauvin was a rare occurrence, not least because in this case, an officer's actions were recorded by bystanders and shown to the jury in court. That followed months of the video being played repeatedly on TV, imprinted in the minds of Americans everywhere. With police pressure mounting on all sides, Biden is urging Congress to plunge back into policing legislation. "We can't stop here," he said Tuesday after the verdict. In private, Scott briefed key Republican senators on Wednesday, updating his colleagues on quiet negotiations that have been underway with Democrats for nearly 2 months. He told reporters he expected to wrap up those talks with the Democrats within 2 weeks. "We've made tremendous progress," Scott said on Capitol Hill. "Democrats say they are ready. This has to come to a stop," said Representative James Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina, the highest-ranking black elected official in Congress after the Chauvin verdict. He and others, including Scott, have told wrenching stories of their own experience with law enforcement well into their adult lives as elected officials serving in the most powerful corridors of Congress struggled with the police overhaul bill last summer in the immediate aftermath of Floyd's death, but the legislation went nowhere after Democrats and Republicans could not agree to a compromise package. The House, led by Democrats, has now twice approved a sweeping overhaul. The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, that would be the most substantial federally ordered change to policing in a generation. The bill would allow police officers to be sued and damages awarded for violating people's constitutional rights, limiting qualified immunity protections now in place for law enforcement. The legislation would ban the use of chokeholds and would create a national database of police misconduct in an effort to prevent bad apple officers from being hired by other departments. A Republican bill from Scott does not go as far as the House-passed measure. It was blocked last year by Senate Democrats, a fact the Republicans are emphasizing. All right, back to the front page of the Courier. Our next and last article on the front page for Thursday, April 22nd, Earth Day, is Governor pushes vaccinations as demand lags. 43 counties this week reject new shipments, by journalist Aaron Murphy, Courier, Des Moines Bureau. Johnston: the number of Iowa counties that did not need their entire allotment of COVID-19 vaccines more than doubled over the past week and now includes nearly half of the state. With those numbers in mind, Governor Kim Reynolds on Wednesday made a plea to Iowans who are hesitant about getting the vaccine. "We are making great progress, but we can always do better, and in this case, we absolutely should," Reynolds said Wednesday during her weekly press conference at Iowa PBS Studios. "Today, I want to appeal to everyone who's hesitating. If you're opting to wait and see what you are waiting for, if you've had a hard no from the start, what's your reason? And if you can't answer those questions, we hope that you take the time to reconsider." 43 of Iowa's 99 counties this week rejected vaccine shipments from the state because they have not yet used previous allotments, state public health officials said. That's up from 20 counties just 1 week prior. Most of those 43 counties are clustered in the state's northwest region, public health officials said. Reynolds' administration, and this article continues on page 5, listeners, underneath vaccination. Addressing the issue by dispatching Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg, a native of Hardin in Sioux County, to Western Iowa to receive his COVID-19 vaccination. Gregg received the shot during a public clinic Friday in Sioux City. Reynolds said vaccine hesitancy is not unique to Iowa and appears to be most prevalent among younger people. But when asked about an Associated Press NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research poll from late March, in which 36% of Republicans said they probably or definitely would not get vaccinated, compared to just 12% of Democrats, Reynolds questioned the validity of the poll. That's your poll, but I think we need to look larger scale, and we need to really do a deep dive and really take a look at why. What's behind it? What can we do to help ensure Iowans that they are safe and this is the right thing to do, especially as we work to open back up and just continue to get life back to normal? Reynolds cited Kaiser Family Foundation research indicating that age is a factor in resistance to getting vaccinated, with the highest resistance among adults ages 18 to 39. Those results likely reflect a sense of security among young adults who typically experience only mild illness from the virus and are generally less concerned about preventative care, said Reynolds, who repeatedly warned people to be proactive in stopping the spread of the virus, but adamantly opposes mandatory restrictions and quickly reopened businesses. However, Kaiser's study also have consistently shown significant reluctance among Republicans to get vaccinated. For example, Kaiser reported in March that about 3 to 10 Republicans, 29%, and a similar share of white adults who identify as evangelical Christian, 28%, say they will definitely not get the vaccine. That study indicated 5% of Democrats and 9% of independents said that they would not get the vaccine. Of the 43 Iowa counties to decline vaccines, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has identified 12 as having high rates of coronavirus transmissions. Voter registration information shows all 12 are heavily Republican counties. Reynolds says she plans to ask respected community and religious leaders to encourage vaccine resistors to change their minds and get immunized. Whatever the reason, it's important to understand why certain groups may be hesitant so that we can continue to do everything that we can to take a more targeted approach to providing that information and vaccination options that are the most relevant for them, Reynolds said. Reynolds said vaccine doses does not needed in some counties are being reallocated to more populous areas where there is still demand. Joining Reynolds at the press conference was Major General Ben Corral, Adjutant General for the Iowa National Guard. Corral described his bout with COVID-19 in November. He said he was hospitalized for a week and still feels symptoms of the virus, including fatigue and shortness of breath. Corral said he completed his COVID-19 vaccination in March. Recently, we gained a tool to help stop this virus from perpetuating. We now have vaccines. We now have renewed hope to move forward without this plague following us, bringing us sickness and death, Corral said. I had no hesitation in becoming vaccinated. I believe getting vaccinated is doing my part in helping stop the cycle of spreading the virus. For those of you sitting on the fence wondering about getting vaccinated, do it. It's the right thing to do for you, for your family, and your neighbors, and our community. Join us in being part of the solution to end this. Corral said roughly about half of Iowa Guard members have not yet been vaccinated. He said vaccination is not at this point a requirement for service and employed Guard members to also get vaccinated. CDC data shows that Iowa has fully vaccinated 920,481 people, or just 29.2% of its population. That is the 15th highest rate of any state. Iowa health officials on Wednesday reported 691 additional confirmed COVID-19 cases and 7 more deaths from the disease, pushing the state's pandemic toll to 5,893. Stay safe, Iowa. All right, well, that does it for the front page of the Courier. Let's look at some Cedar Valley news. American Dream. After Ecuador move, couple aids students' efforts to attend UNI, by journalist Andrew Wind, Cedar Falls. Shannon and Bryn Frederick may have expected their children to show some interest in attending the University of Northern Iowa. After all, it's their alma mater, and Bryn's father and stepmother are each retired from the university's faculty. Their oldest son, Joe, is a graduate from UNI as well, and the campus is on the radar of their son, Quincy, as he considers where to attend next fall. Our Panther blood runs pretty deep, said Bryn, but the couple had no inkling that they'd be supporting yet another Northern Iowa student this fall when accepting jobs last year to teach in Ecuador. Before taking the 2-year assignment, Shannon was a Spanish teacher in Janesville Consolidated School, and Bryn was an early childhood special education consultant for Central Rivers Area Education Agency. After the Fredericks moved to Guayaquil, Ecuador, with Quincy and their daughter Piper, they met Paul Shelley, the head of maintenance at the International American Academy, where they are teachers. Paul's son David became friends with Quincy. As Bryn solidified a friendship with Paul, he confided in her that his family didn't have the resources to send David to college. David's situation is unique, she noted. He attends the private school on a scholarship because of his father's employment there, beginning 36 years ago on the janitorial staff. I actually started at IAA at the age of 4, said David. His 2 older brothers also attended the academy, a full immersion American-style school taught all subjects, where all subjects are taught in English. Tuition is well over $10,000 per year, an amount David's parents would not have been able to afford without that scholarship. David is a good student who said he exceeded my family's expectations in his education. After starting high school, the goal became to continue on to college, where he could study biology. He is motivated to succeed as a way to help my nieces and nephews and prove that your family doesn't have to have money to go to college in the States. However, without some assistance to continue his education, it kind of comes to an end, said Bryn. Choosing you and I, the couple began looking at getting David to the United States College, which required someone to sponsor him. When they started talking to people about it, Bryn said, a dozen people volunteered to be sponsors, until learning that meant they were responsible for the cost of his education. So, Shannon and Bryn decided they would sponsor David, but they were still a long way from knowing where he would go to college. Shannon noted that they started really researching and looking into schools in October. In my short list, I had a total of 14 universities that I applied to, said David, most of which waived the application fee. That included both places where David knew someone and where tuition was lower. David got accepted into all of the schools he applied to, said Shannon, which included scholarship offers. He got a substantial scholarship from UNI, but obviously not the whole thing. Those international students and academic scholarships, which he can keep in future years by maintaining a 3.0 grade point average, helped David choose UNI, along with the fact that it is in the Fredericks' hometown. Generally, the cost to attend the university is pretty competitive nationally. Our cost of tuition is below the national average for both public and private institutions, said Christy Monchanti, Director of International Recruitment and Admissions at UNI. It's still a big commitment. Finding funding. She noted that David will be among 350 students from 64 countries outside the United States attending the university in the fall. A number of factors have decreased that from 600 international students several years ago. Policies of former President Donald Trump and the COVID-19 pandemic have limited the number of students. A change in the universities included in scholarships provided by Saudi Arabia, once UNI's largest source of international students, has also cut into the numbers. Currently, the most foreign students come from China, and very few come from South America, where David lives. Marchanti said where international students apply to UNI, they must meet academic standards, prove a minimum of English proficiency, and have the funding for a year of college cost. There are various fees to pay as they go through the immigration process, plus an interview at the U.S. Embassy to get their visa. One of the things that I've been impressed with David and many international students is his determination, even with all the barriers and obstacles. He is so excited about coming here. He's so determined to make sure he has the opportunities to come to the United States and be part of the UNI community. David will pay out-of-state tuition, double the amount Iowa residents pay. Many international students are sponsored by families who cover the cost, while others receive funding from their country's embassy. foreign students can't get college loans or grants, and they can't participate in federally funded on-campus work study. He's very fortunate to have the support he has, said from the Frederick, said Macerti. Around December, the family set up a GoFundMe site to seek donations for David's college cost. He plans to supplement the funds raised by funding on-campus employment, which he can do for up to 20 hours per week. Prince said they are hoping to raise $20,000 for the first year, and then, following the first year, $10,000 for each of the next years. We're at $8,000 now, almost half of what we need for this first year. So that's pretty exciting. While the family continues seeking donations, enough has been raised to move forward with plans to come to UNI. He's got his airline tickets now, so this is a done deal, said Bryn. David graduates May 28th and will head to Iowa in July. Among those donating to the cause are alums of Inter-America Academy, who remember David's dad, where he was a janitor 30 years ago in their kindergarten classroom. She added, but complete strangers have made donations as well. It's been a humbling experience, said Bryn. All right. Listeners, you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Falls Waterloo paper, The Courier, for Thursday, April 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Lolita Lilbit Arlene Bennett, Lisbon. Lolita Lilbit Arlene Bennett, 66, of Lisbon, died Sunday, April 18, 2021, at her home. A private family service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed at the funeral home's website under the obituary for Lolita Bennett, under the video tab starting at 11 a.m. on Tuesday. Burial at Cedar Memorial Cemetery. There will be a visitation from 5 to 8 p.m. on Monday at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. Following the continued guidance from the health officials, physical distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is required. Lolita was a loving, caring, and amazing friend, sister, mother, and grandmother. She was born to Arnold Steffens and Willie Mae Dauby on August 25, 1954, in Jacksonville, Florida. After a short stop in Oklahoma, Lolita made her way to Albuquerque, New Mexico. She is survived by two sons, Derek and Marcus, and Cameron Steffens, and a brother, William Steffens. She is also survived by three grandchildren, Jaden, Brooklyn, and London. She was preceded in death by her parents and an infant daughter, Desiree. After retiring from Hewlett-Packard, Lolita set a path to graduate from college. She earned degrees from Kirkwood Community College and Ashford University. One of Lolita's passions was helping people. She volunteered at Unity Point and the Lisbon Rehab Center. Lolita loved to dance, sing, spend time with her grandbabies. Her smile and laugh would make the darkest room as light as day. She will be missed dearly. A memorial fund has been established. Bill Outenson, Waterloo, 90, of Friendship Village, died Tuesday, April 20, 2021, at his home. William Paul Outenson was born August 6, 1930, in Sioux City, son of Niles Virgin and Gertrude Ann Berg Outenson. He served in the United States Army, 1952 to 1954. He graduated from Iowa State University with a bachelor's degree of science in architectural engineering. Bill married Norma Lee Woolery, December 18, 1955, in Kansas City, Missouri. Bill was office engineer for the city of Waterloo from 1960 to 1966, then was an engineer with Robinson Engineering, retiring after 34 years as vice president in 2000. He was a member of Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church, member and past master of Waterloo Masonic Lodge No. 105, AF and AM, past patron of the Cedar Valley Chapter No. 128, Order of Eastern Star, life member of the American Society of Civil Engineers, past president of the Consulting Engineering Council of Iowa, and member of the Iowa Engineering Society. Bill is survived by his wife, Norma, daughter Barbara, and her spouse, Gregory Ehrich of Cedar Falls, son Edward, and spouse Carolyn of Waterloo, three grandchildren, Jason and Kate, Ehrich Page, Ashley and Henry Newman, and Emily Ottenson, three great-grandchildren, Kaden Ottenson, Kaylee Durnall, and Simon Newman, a sister, Marilyn Stephen Dennison of Rapid City, South Dakota. He is preceded in death by his parents and grandson, Benjamin Ottenson. Visitation will be Sunday, April 25th at Locke Funeral Home from 4 to 6 p.m. Funeral services will follow the visitation at 6 p.m. with a Masonic service at 6:30. Cremation to follow services with interment at a later date at Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials to Waterloo Masonic Lodge, number 105, AF and AM, or Zion Lutheran Evangelical Lutheran Church. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Janet Elaine Green, Waterloo, 79, peacefully passed in her home April 17, 2021. She was born August 15, 1941, in Marble Rock, Iowa, had five brothers, and was the daughter of Virginia Fouch and Arthur Hoggins. Jan was a proud employee of the Waterloo McDonald's for over 40 years. Janet and Gary Green were married for 25 years and had three children together, Kimberly, Tamara, and Troy, six grandchildren and four great-grandchilden. She is preceded in death by her parents, her son Troy, four brothers, and the great Elvis Presley. Celebration of life will be on April 24th at Majestic Moon, 1955 Locke Avenue, Waterloo, Iowa, 50702, from 3 to 5 p.m. Memorandum can be sent to Majestic Moon Friday or Saturday after 1 by Venmo at Tamara-Green-1. Claudia Jo Cryer, Waterloo, 72, was called home on April 11th, surrounded by her family. She was born January 27, 1949, to the late Charles Sr. and Gwendolyn Perkins Schaff. A memorial service will be held Saturday, May 1st at 11 a.m. at the Union Missionary Baptist Church, 209 Jackson Street. Memorials can be directed to the family at 426 Oliver Street, Waterloo, Iowa, 50703. Let's see what kind of other Iowa news you might find interesting. Well, this one is LeVar Burton to be Jeopardy guest host. Maybe you're a Jeopardy fan, listeners. Los Angeles. The 200,000-plus LeVar Burton boosters who signed a petition calling for him to be the new Jeopardy host will get to see him try the job on for size. Burton is among the final group of guest hosts for the quiz show, which lost its longtime host, Alex Trebek, who died of cancer last November, and has put off announcing his successor. Burton's supporters seized the opportunity to launch an online petition for the star, who starred on the Star Trek The Next Generation and Roots and was the host of Reading Rainbow, the children's educational program. In his career, Burton has inspired and shaped the minds of several generations of trivia-loving nerds, according to the petition that as of Wednesday had 246,000 and counting signatures. In an email, a spokeswoman for Burton said he believes the petition drive and his social media interactions with fans were factors in the invitation for him to be a guest host. There was no immediate reply to a request for comment from producer Sony Picture Television. TV anchors and journalists George Stephanopoulos and Robin Roberts of ABC and David Farber of CNBC and sportscaster Joe Buck are the other temp hosts getting one-week stints. Sony said Wednesday the air dates weren't announced. Who do you think, listeners, will be our next guest host on Jeopardy? Okay, let's turn to some sports news. Bring up the sports page. Our headline for that is Peterson Achieves Her Final Four Dream. Dyke New Hartford volleyball star has been a key part of the Texas back row by journalist Jim Nelson. It's accompanied with a colorful picture of Texas libero Sydney Peterson records a dig during one of her matches last season. The moment was monumental for Sydney Peterson, and she celebrated with her University of Texas teammates with pure jubilation. It wasn't until much later that it really began to sink in. Monday night, Peterson and Texas defeated Nebraska in four sets to advance to the Final Four of the NCAA Division I volleyball tournament in Omaha. Peterson is a defensive specialist within a Longhorns program that reached the national semifinals for the ninth time in the past 13 seasons. It is this experience that Peterson dreamed about back in 2016 when the then Dyke New Hartford star announced she'd continue her volleyball career playing for the Longhorns. "I feel like it hasn't sunk in yet," Peterson said. "My teammates were like, we can't really believe we just did that. We got back to our hotel and sat there eating dinner, and we were like, we really just did that. We can't believe it." The fourth-ranked Longhorns will face top-ranked Wisconsin tonight at 8 p.m. on ESPN inside the CHI Health Center Arena in Omaha. This will be the first Final Four for the junior back row specialist after falling short in her first two seasons at Texas. Peterson started as libero as a true freshman on the 2018 team that lost in the regional finals. A year later, and again after 27 starts as libero, Peterson and the Longhorns were upset by Louisville in the second round of the NCAA tournament. "It has always been a dream of mine," Peterson said. "It's why I chose to go to Texas. It's a dream come true, and it's just amazing." This actually won't be the first time Peterson has been intimately involved with the Final Four in Omaha. Her mom, University of Northern Iowa head coach Bobby Peterson, took Sydney and her twin sister Bailey to several national semifinals and championships when they were growing up. Sydney Peterson admits that previous experience probably won't benefit her against the Badgers, but it will benefit her in other ways. "I actually went to a Final Four in Omaha when I was really young. I've been here before, but I really don't remember it. Being in Omaha and being so close to home, it's kind of nice. A bunch of my family gets to come to the game. I've had 22 people on my pass list every day. It's nice to see them from a distance up in the stands and give them a little wave at the end of games. To see their faces is awesome." Peterson would call this season definitely unusual. The Longhorns played the bulk of their season in the fall as the Big 12 was one of a few conferences to play a full slate of conference matches during what is normally the regular season for college volleyball. Texas only played 13 of its 27 matches, including four NCAA tournament matches after New Year's Day. Peterson also adjusted to a new role within the Longhorns' back row, within a deep and talented team full of star players. Illinois grad transfer Morgan O'Brien was inserted as libero. Peterson, who has played in all 27 matches, has assumed a new on-court responsibility. "I'm definitely rolling with it," said Peterson, who enters the Final Four with 851 career digs. "We had a lot of competition on our team, and we are just going to put the best players out there. It has been a little bit different going from left back to right back, but with the coaches we have and all the support, I feel like I'm making a good move to right back. I've had my coaches and teammates to thank, as they have really helped me in practice. I still feel like I'm a big part of the team, communicating with the back row, with the libero and outside hitters, and just being a strong player and a rock back there for whenever my team needs me." Peterson points out the left back to right back positions probably look similar, but in reality, each location on court is unique. The angles are all different. It's a little different having a middle come at you at right back from left back. Just a lot more communication with the middles and front row and in different angles. In the end, Peterson is happy to fill whatever role head coach Jarrett Elliott asked her to fill out, and is looking forward to the challenges of playing Wisconsin. Not going to lie, it's going to be a dogfight. We're both two really good, talented teams. I feel like it's going to come down to who makes less errors and who's going to be grinding for every point. As far as what it'll be like to play in the Final Four, Peter Sassen, the regional against Nebraska in the Cornhuskers' backyard, has prepared the Longhorns. A win Thursday, which Peterson is hoping for, will delay that interaction until following Saturday's championship match. Dad and Mom both made it down for at least one of the games this spring, Peterson said, so I got to see them at least once, but I haven't seen my twin sister or my little sister or my other family yet. Seeing them for the first time this past week, I wanted to run up and give them all hugs, but I couldn't. That was sad. Good luck to the Longhorns. Other news in the sports. Panthers and Bray relays at Drake by Nick Petraeus. Cedar Falls. One glance at the NCAA's national track and field event list reveals limited opportunities for collaboration. The 4x100 and the 4x400 are the only championship relay events that take place outdoors. Meets such as this weekend's Drake Relays provide a rare opportunity for collegiate athletes to break the grind of individual event training. We are going to put more of the emphasis on all of our relays, University of Northern Iowa coach Dave Paulson said. This year, I think more than ever, the relays will just bring something different to the team as far as running things we normally don't get to run in other meets. When UI's coach unveiled their relay pairings during practice leading up to Drake, plenty of excitement ensues. Sprinters, middle distance, and distance runners find themselves working together on a medley. The four best 800 runners on the team all of a sudden have a chance to win a championship flag. It's a lot of fun when you tell them who is on what relay. They hop across and talk to that other event group and let them know that they're excited to be on it, Paulson said. In the state of Iowa, we have more relays in high school than any other state in the country. These kids are used to running those events. So when you take it all away, that's all they've ever known. When you get a chance to go back and tell them they're running the 4x8, they just lose it. They're super excited to do those things because it's something that they loved to do when they were in high school. There's just something different about relays that kind of bring everyone together. This year's events will have a different feel than the three-day carnival atmosphere that could be found in previous years at Drake Stadium. Crowds are likely to be much smaller beyond the already limited seating due to COVID-19 protocol. Colleges are competing on Friday and Saturday, while the high school athletes that typically fill the stadium with supporters will take the track today. Still, the competition will remain strong. The freshmen from Iowa on UNI's team have been waiting 2 years for an opportunity to return to this track. It'll be a little bit different of a vibe. I know our student athletes missed being there last year and are definitely looking forward to the opportunity. I think if anything, 2020 taught us just to be grateful and thankful for the opportunities that you have. Take full advantage of those regardless of atmosphere and circumstances. The competition will be good. Good luck to the Panthers and all running at Drake. All right, I think we have time for one more article from the sports section. And it's King Eyes Drake Crown, accompanied with a colorful picture. The caption reads, UNI's Darius King celebrates his championship in the shot put at the Missouri Valley Conference indoor meet earlier this season inside the Unidome. UNI's new shot put record holder has found consistency, by journalist Nick Petraeus, Cedar Falls. During a competition in which Darius King etched his name into the University of Northern Iowa's record book, the Panther shot putter had a front row seat to one of the world's elites. Former Purdue first team All-American Chukwuebuka Inakawaki, an Olympic qualifier for Nigeria, was competing unattached on Saturday's Gibson International in Terre Haute, Indiana. All six of Inakawaki's attempts surpassed 20 meters, including a winning mark of 21.03 meters, which is 69 feet. That ranks seventh among the outdoor world leaders during this Olympic year. That's insane to see in person, King said. I see it on YouTube all the time, but to see somebody do it in person was pretty cool. doing what he has to do to execute every throw really is what I've learned. I've had to do it every time, not just one time, and pray that it happens again. After he finished his 2019 outdoor season a few centimeters shy of a school record, King became the first UNI shot putter to surpass 20 meters in competition when he marked 20.14, which is 66 feet, 1 inch, on his first attempt at the Gibson International Event Final. Justin Baker held the previous school record at 19.36 meters since 2016. The type of consistency King saw Inouye execute on every attempt is surfacing more during his junior season with the Panthers. Darius's consistency has been terrific this year, UNI coach Dave Paulson said of King, who placed 12th and secured second-team All-American honors at last March's NCAA Indoor Championship. That's something that kind of missed in the past. He'd throw a big one and then have a few meets where he wasn't so good. He's just been solid across the board all season, indoors and outdoors. He's starting to consistently throw those 19 mids on a regular basis, and he's got a bigger one in there that he can throw this weekend. I can't wait to see when that happens. A native of Moline, Illinois, King admits he didn't know anything about the Drake Relays until joining UNI track and field team. The atmosphere and competition have now made this event one of his favorite regular season meets of the schedule. King will be challenged by a shot put field that includes a pair of competitors from North Dakota State that rank among the top 9 in the NCAA West region. Good luck to King and all at the Drake Relays. They have a beautiful weather for it. All right, listeners, I think we're ready to end with my favorite part of the paper, and it might be yours too, called Call the Courier. Question: what is the difference between being a migrant and an immigrant? Answer: the word migrant replies to a temporary condition, while an immigrant is someone who has moved permanently from one country to another. We have noticed the terms being used basically interchangeably to refer to refugees, asylum seekers, and would-be immigrants. Question: has Iowa ever considered having tolls? Answer: it has been discussed, but enjoys little support among Iowa politicians. In 2018, Iowa Department of Transportation study found that tolls were a feasible way to fund expansion of the Interstate 80, but Mark Lowe, then director of the DOT, said he would not recommend such changes. Question: why doesn't the new phone book have Blackhawk County or Iowa State Patrol listed anywhere in it? Answer: that's a question for the company publishing the phone book. Question: on the Iron Man Battalion article you reported, where was Major Hart? You listed a lot of other officials in the article, but not him. Answer: he was not in attendance, though his office says Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart planned to attend before the time of the homecoming was adjusted, which conflicted with another appointment he had on his calendar. Mayor Hart appreciates the work of the men and women of our military and was disappointed he couldn't be present. Spokesperson Wendy Bowman said he did attend the send-off event and looks forward to attending the upcoming homecoming. Question: what is the status of the old Greyhound Park? Is it just going to be a parking lot for semi-trucks forever? Answer: Waterloo Planning Director Noel Anderson said the city and Deer Creek Development are working to attract new businesses to the site. Anderson said it is ready for development. Question: what is the status of the grocery store that is supposed to be built on Franklin Street? Answer: the developer is expected to restart construction in the next few weeks, following winter weather, said Noel Anderson, city planning director. He said the footings for the planned grocery store, All In Grocers, are already installed in the fall. Question: has a traffic study been done around the new theme park location? Answer: traffic patterns were reviewed for lane configurations, turning lanes, and other adjoining parcel development as part of the Shawless Road redevelopment project, said Noel Anderson, city planning director. Question: will they be putting up the U.S. flag again over at the U.S. Highway 218 and Texas Street? Answer. Yes, according to the city planning director, Noel Anderson, he said the flagpole was replaced by the cellular company and a new rigging system will be installed soon for the flag. Question. The governor was talking about vaccine passports. Could you explain that, what those are? Answer. Vaccine passports are credentials that prove you have been vaccinated against COVID-19 so you can resume activities like air travel or attending concerts and sporting events. For example, Israel issues a green passport that allows vaccinated individuals to go to restaurants and attend public gatherings, barred or limited by lockdowns. Question, does Denver, Iowa have Meals on Wheels? And what about Hudson? Answer, yes. Qualified residents can arrange meal deliveries by calling 1-800-770-8707. Calls are taken on a special courier phone line at 234-3566. Questions are answered by the courier staff and the staff at the Waterloo Public Library. And that does it today, listeners, for Earth Day. That's the reading of today's paper of the Waterloo Courier for April 22nd, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can get a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org anytime. Thanks for listening.